Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. So this talk's going to be a little bit different to the ones that's gone before, because I'm going to talk about microfluidics, specifically droplet-based microfluidics for digital biology. So I think a good place to start is, what's droplet-based microfluidics? For us, the story starts back in really 2004, when we started to collaborate with a group of Dave Waits, who's a physicist at Harvard, who was developing beautiful microfluidic systems to manipulate fluids and make droplets. And in fact, in microfluidic systems, you can create beautiful monodisperse emulsions where all the droplets are basically the same size at rates of over 10,000 per second. And for us, the idea is really just to use each droplet, like the well of a microtiter plate, a little independent microreactor, but with a they have a volume of typically between about a nanoliter and a picoliter, which means that they're a thousand to a million times smaller than the smallest volume that you can work with in microtiter plate wells. But you can do all sorts of other really fun things with droplets in microfluidic systems. For example, you can fuse droplets together, in this case using electrical fields. You can also destabilize the interface with electrical fields to allow controlled injection of defined volumes of liquids into droplets. This is so-called pico injection. And you can also just inject into a certain subset of droplets if you want to. And we can separate out droplets based on their size. You can mix the contents of droplets by sending them as these little chicanes in just 2 milliseconds. We can split droplets symmetrically and asymmetrically. You can incubate droplets on chip in different sorts of delay lines. And for longer incubations, you can just simply take the droplets off chip and incubate them in a syringe, for example, and then re-inject them on chip again. We can measure the fluorescence in drops, multiple curls at the same time. It's a bit like a flow cytometer. And we can sort the droplets triggered on fluorescence at up to about 2,000 droplets per second, as you can see here. This is using dielectrophoresis. And once we've collected droplets, we can then break the emulsion. This is breaking by electrical essence, and we can recover the contents to do other assays. And we can use microfabrication techniques to create integrated microfluidic chips, where the layout and the modules we use just depends on the application. So here, for example, you have a relatively simple device. When I get this to work, I should have tried it before. Okay. So it starts off with a droplet maker around here. Then you have a delay line to allow incubation. And then there's a fluorescence-activated droplet sorter up here. And what's really nice is that these chips are quite simple because they have no moving parts. So the first thing I want to talk about is a little adventure in prebiotic chemistry. So Charles Darwin famously said that he imagined that life might have arisen in some in a warm little pond. But in fact, the problem is in solution, entropic factors thermodynamically disfavor the formation of larger molecules from smaller ones. And this has led to quite strong criticism of the prebiotic broth theory for the origin of life. But what if droplets might have been prebiotic chemical reactors? A few years ago, Chris Dobson proposed that water in atmospheric aerosol droplets, which are about a micron in diameter, which originally formed at the ocean surface, might go into the atmosphere and evaporate, concentrating the aqueous solutions and therefore favor synthetic reactions. But in fact, at the time, the potential important role of the droplet interface was overlooked. This is a small droplet, so the surface-to-volume ratio is very high. So we set out to investigate this using a very simple reaction. It's the reaction of a non-fluorescent amine with a non-fluorescent aldehyde to form a fluorescent imine. And the imine formation in aqueous solution, it's kinetically and thermodynamically highly disfavored. So we set out to see what happened if you perform this reaction in droplets in a water and oil emulsion, making droplets of different sizes. And what we found out was that imine formation becomes more favorable in picoliter volume droplets. And the smaller droplets are, the more favorable it is. And in fact, if you look at this in a bit more detail, what you see is that the equilibrium constant and the forward rate constant, K1, are inversely proportional to the radius of the droplet, whereas the reverse rate constant, K-1, is independent of the droplet radius. And if you convert this into free energies, what you see is that there's an increase in the free energy of the reactants relative to the product. But the free energy of the transition state doesn't change, so this indicates that transition state stabilization is insignificant. It indicates it's not a catalytic mechanism. But instead, the results can be explained by a non-catalytic reaction adsorption diffusion model. So reactants adsorb to the droplet interface with relatively low binding energies, a few kBT, and then they react at the interface, and then the products diffuse back to bulk. So this is the reaction in bulk again. But with the drops, what you have is you have the free amine aldehyde bind with low affinity at the interface. Then at the interface, they're no longer in a three-dimensional space, they're in a quasi-two-dimensional space, so the synthetic reaction is more efficient, so you get formation of the product. And then this fluorescent product then diffuses back into the bulk. And so in fact, what you have is you have a continual flux of this fluorescent product back into the droplet. And this is where you get the 1 over R ratio, because the surface-to-volume ratio is equal to 3 over R. So this is basically a universal mechanism that can work to improving any unfavorable synthetic reaction when you have a low affinity of the reactants for the interface. Another thing we found from the theoretical analysis was that at equilibrium, so the distribution of the product in the drop depends on the decay length, xi, which in this case is about 500 microns. And this is the typical distance of which a product molecule diffuses in a time 1 over k minus 1. And when R is much greater than xi, the product is only present in the interfacial region. But when R is much less than psi, the product can diffuse many times of the droplet size before it decays. And so the substrate and product profiles are flat. So what this means is product can only accumulate when the droplet ratio is equal to, droplet radius is equal to or less than psi. And so what you're seeing here is a quite interesting phenomenon, because the reaction thermodynamics is modified by compartmentalization at the mesoscale, so there's no confinement at the molecular scale. These droplets are much larger than molecules, obviously. So I now want to move to another little example. So this is after life has got started. This is an investigation of the RNA world, where the idea is to use droplets as protocell analogs. So a bit of history. So the Q-beta bacteriophage, this is a 4,500 base pair double-stranded RNA genome, which is replicated by the Q-beta replicase. And back in 1972, Sol Spiegelman performed this very nice experiment where he found that if you took the Q-beta genome and you took it through 74 generations of replication, the genome reduced, replicated by Q-beta replicase, the genome reduced in size down to 218 base pairs. And the RNA, little RNA created, he called his little monster. And what this is a very simple Darwinian selection for RNAs that replicate more quickly. But this demonstrates a quite interesting and a slightly disturbing tendency of RNA replicators, indeed any replicator. But in bulk, parasitic RNAs, this is RNAs that replicate quickly but have no other function or activity, are thought, on the basis of theory, to take over and destroy Darwinian systems comprising single replicating RNAs or more complex systems like hypercycles. So, however, compartmentalization reproducing processes is thought to inhibit parasite takeover. But then the problem is, how could functional collapse due to parasites have been avoided before the evolution of stable reproducing replicating protocells? So it's kind of a chicken and egg problem. And so we set out to investigate whether it was possible that a more rudimentary type of population structure, where replicators undergo cycles of mixing and interaction in local groups, especially a trait group model, could also provide resistance against parasitic RNAs. So the idea here is that you have a pool of RNAs, they get compartmentalized into protocells or something else, then you get replication and catalysis inside. And then those protocells, those compartments where you have active catalysts, essentially survive, and more of the RNAs from these compartments get passed onto the pool from the compartments where you have, which are basically infested by parasites where there's no functional activity. And then the whole cycle goes around again. And we mimic this in a very simple way. We're using a microfluidic system. So we take a pool of RNAs, we compartmentalize into droplets, one or less RNA molecules per droplet. We replicate them in the droplets. The RNAs also have a catalytic activity. And if there's a catalytic activity, the droplets become fluorescent. So we can sort out the active droplets, throw away the inactive droplets, and we go through cycles of replication like this. So what we're doing is, just like Spiegelman, we're replicating an RNA using a Q-beta replicase in the droplet. But what we have is we have embedded in the RNA, we have the VS ribozyme. The VS ribozyme catalyzes the formation of a fluorescent product in the drops. So basically, the ribozyme activity is used to mimic a metabolic activity. So fluorescent droplets can be sorted and we can recover them. And so this is what you can see. You can monitor replication of RNA, which is green fluorescence, which uses an intercalating dye. And the ribosome activity can be monitored using the orange fluorescence production. And you can monitor this simultaneously in drops. So here you see dot plots. You have the orange fluorescence versus green fluorescence. And if you don't do any selection for the droplets based on the catalytic activity, what you see is that by the time you get to round 9, there are no longer any orange fluorescence droplets, so it means that all the functional catalysts have disappeared. However, if you select the high orange fluorescent droplets, so these are the ones with active catalysts, you see that by round 9, you still have lots of nice droplets containing active catalysts. And if you look at what's happening to the original wild-type ribozyme, what you see is that in bulk, it's basically become extinct by about round 3 or 4. If you compartmentalize the reaction, but you don't select based on the catalytic activity, the ribozyme also becomes extinct, but it takes a bit longer. But if in addition you select the compartments based on the catalytic activity, you find that the wild-type ribozyme, at least by round 9, has not become extinct. And we also monitored what was going on by deep sequencing. So in bulk, you see that parasites appear very quickly. If you have compartmentalization but no selection of the compartments, the parasites appear more slowly. But you see this higher parasite diversity. And if you compartmentalize and select the compartments based on the activity of the ribozyme, the parasites appear even more slowly, but you see there's much higher parasite diversity. So to cut a long story short, this is what's going on. When you do the selection in bulk, what happens is that rapidly the fastest parasite takes over, and the wild-type ribozyme, active ribozyme, becomes extinct. If you carry out a compartmentalized selection, then the wild-type ribozyme becomes extinct more slowly, but once again, eventually, the fastest parasite takes over. But if you compartmentalize and you select the compartments based on the catalytic activity, you see something very intriguing. What happens is that the wild-type ribozyme does not become extinct. In fact, it comes into equilibrium with the slowest parasite. So in fact, what's happening here is that this is this purely in vitro system. Slow parasites have evolved. They've basically adapted to coexist in drops with the wild type. So they essentially don't kill the activity in the droplet. So just like a natural parasite, they've evolved. They've adapted to the host, and the host in this case is a droplet. Another interesting feature is that these very diverse parasitic RNAs could potentially serve as an important source of genetic diversity and opportunistic functionality. So, and I want to move on to something a little bit different, which is really digital biology. So, which for the point of view of this talk today, I just mean massively parallel analysis of single molecules or cells. And first of all, analysis of a single DNA molecules. So it's also extremely interesting for clinicians to be able to detect mutations that come from DNA in cancer cells for diagnosis, patient stratification, and follow-up. But the problem is that if you take samples, for example, of feces or blood, most of the genes in there come from completely healthy tissues and so are not from the tumor and they're unmutated. So any test you want to do has to be highly sensitive. And if you carry out a classic analog sort of Tachman-style assay, it's very difficult to detect less than a 0.1% mutant sequence in a background of wild-type sequence. But you can carry out a digital assay where you individually compartmentalize the molecules, the target genes in this case, into drops. This is highly sensitive because in every drop, you either have a wild type or a mutant sequence and nothing else. So in fact, the sensitivity of the technique, at least in principle, is only if determined by the number of compartments, which in our case is the number of droplets. So in practice, what you do is you take the DNA, you dilate it so there's less than one target gene per droplet. It's just a Poisson distribution. And then you amplify by PCR. So this is a Tachman assay, screening for genomic DNA with a mutation in the KRAS oncogene. So homozygous wild type, they're either all red or non-fluorescent. Homozygous mutant, they're all green or non-fluorescent. And heterozygous, you get a mixture of reds and greens, as you would expect. And you can determine the absolute quantity of a target gene just by fitting the fraction of fluorescent droplets to a Poisson distribution. And in fact, it's incredibly sensitive. It allows the detection of one mutant in the background of 200,000 wild-type genes, so it's several orders of magnitude more sensitive than classical tests. And in fact, there are now two droplet-based digital PCR systems which are commercialized as the Raindrop system from Raindust Technologies and the QX200 system from Bio-Rad. But what I want to concentrate on for the rest of the talk is a single cell analysis, because the scale of these systems is very well adapted to study as single cells. So, for example, we can put mammalian cells in this case into single cell per droplet. Once again, they're going with a Poisson distribution. And what I want to talk about first of all is the discovery of therapeutic antibodies using this kind of technology. And this is a collaboration with Hi-Fi Bio, which is a spin-off that's at USPCA, but also with labs in Cambridge, Massachusetts. As we heard earlier, every respectable biologist now has to have a startup. So why is it interesting to go after therapeutic antibodies? I think this little graph really tells it all. So in 2012, the global therapeutic antibody market was over $40 billion per annum. And amazingly, seven of the top 10 selling pharmaceuticals were antibodies. And Humira, which is still the world's top selling drug, here is an antibody which neutralizes TNF-alpha. So we set out to try and develop a highly efficient search engine, basically, for antibody discovery. But it's not just a microfluidic system. In fact, it combines microfluidics with next-gen sequencing and also eventually with synthetic biology. So the idea is we take B cells or plasma cells, in this case, from immunized animals or humans. We put single drops into microfluidic systems. Then we form functional assays at the single cell level. And we can sort out the droplets which are expressing antibodies with the activity we're interested in. Then we extract the sequences using a barcoded next-gen sequencing. It's analyzed by bioinformatics. And then the antibodies here are recovered or resynthesized, maybe humanized. And the idea is to be able to get in less than 2 months to validated lead candidates. So the aim is to produce high-resolution genotype or phenotype maps of the immune repertoire. And the workflow is divided into two. So the first step is screening, so this is for the phenotype of the antibodies. And the second step is the sequencing, which is the genotype. So I'll walk you through it. So the first step is to encapsulate B cells, or in fact plasma cells, and assay reagents. Then you incubate to allow antibody secretion. So single cells, they go with a Poisson distribution, they remain viable for at least 6 hours in these little droplets. And enough antibodies produced by a single cell to allow a binding assay after only 15 minutes. Next, we measure the phenotype, and this could be affinity or some other activity. So, for example, for binding assays, we've developed some quite interesting assays. So this is one which is based on using magnetic colloids. So, in fact, the secreted antibodies are captured onto a magnetic nanobeads. And then the beads are aligned to form a single column in a magnetic field. And then the antibody that's captured onto the beads is then detected using other reagents. So we use green fluorescently labeled antigen to detect antibody binding, and red fluorescently labeled Fab anti-IgG to quantify the amount of bound antibody. And this is what it looks like for real. So this is antigen-antibody merge. And because you can measure the bound and free, and the concentration of antibody, you can measure affinities with this technique. And in fact, you can measure, you can analyze up to a million droplets in a single experiment in this kind of arrays. And so it means you can measure, for example, secretion of IgG from mouse primary plasma cells on many, many individual cells in parallel. And you see that you already have a very good signal after about 10 minutes. If we want to sort the drops, we do it in a slightly different way. So we still have the bead lines in the drops, but in this case, the drops are pushed by the flow in a microfluidic channel past the laser line. And so when the drops go past the laser line, we can read out the binding. So if you have no antigen binding, you have just a red peak. If you have antigen binding, you get a coincident red and a green peak. So this is what it looks like as they come in. You can see the bead lines. You can see the plasma cells in here. So as I said before, so when you get a positive, you get this coincident red, which is the IgG plus sign, and green, which is the antigen signal. So this is what it really looks like as they're going past, and you'll see that every now and again there's a peak popping up over this line, which is the selection threshold. And in fact, when we get a positive, when we get a hit, then we trigger sorting of the cell. This is just a sorting signal coming on here. But the same kind of system can also be adapted to allow cell-based assays. For example, you can do very straightforward assays for binding to cell surface markers, so the target's on the surface of the cell, not on nanobeads in this case. So the primary antibody that we want to test binds to the target, then you have a fluorescent-labeled secondary antibody. So this is an example of binding to a human transmembrane protein. And you see that this is transfected CHO cells, the parental CHO cells, there's really no signal, you get very good discrimination. The next step is to sort the drops based on the phenotype and break the drops and recover the sorted cells. So we start to develop techniques where we can do multi-bin sorting. So this is another example of a sorter. This is a sorting using surface acoustic waves. So you see here when the field goes on, boom, it pops the droplets into this middle channel. But if you put a bit more energy into the surface acoustic wave, you'll see that you can fire them into a top channel, and we've now got more or less working systems with five channels. So having recovered the sorted cells with the phenotypes that we're interested in here, the next step is the sequencing. And this is complicated a bit, of course, by the fact that antibodies are composed of two chains which are encoded by separate genes. The first thing we do is we encapsulate the B cells with barcoded beads, lysis, and RT reagents, and we lyse the cells. So what do we mean by barcoded beads? So what we have is we have beads which have got a so-called cap sequence on them. Then after them, there are a series of barcodes, so sequence barcodes as index A, index B, index C, index D, and each of them is separated by a four base pair sequence which can be a sticky end. So first of all, we take the hydrogel beads with a cap structure on, distribute them into a couple of 96 well plates, and to each well we add a different index A and we ligate it on. And then we pool and then we split again, then we add 192 index Bs, pool, split, 192 index Cs, pool, split, 192 index Ds. And then in the end, what you end up with is a bit over 1.3 billion combinations, and every bead carries a unique barcode. So it basically works really nicely. This is index A, B, C, D, and the gene-specific primer being ligated on. So having made this large bead library, so what we do is we want to combine these hydrogel beads with antibody-secreting cells, lysis and RT reagents. And here we use a little trick. We use the deformability of these hydrogel beads, because they're squidgy, allows you to beat the Poisson distribution. So you can end up with a situation, as you can see here, where almost every droplet contains a single bead. And here you can see a real movie of them going in. So what we want to end up with is a situation here where we have droplets which contain single cells and single beads, and each bead carries a unique sequencing barcode. So here's the barcode structure. You have a biotin to attach it to the bead, photocleavable linker, and then a couple of Illumina sequence ends of the barcode, and then gene-specific primer. In the case of the mouse antibody chains, there are 12 different primers to target to all the different variants of the light chain and the heavy chain. Then we carry out barcoded VH and VLC DNA synthesis. So we lyse the cells in the droplet, the RNA comes out, we release the barcoded cDNA primers off the bead, they prime on the messenger RNA, you generate a cDNA copy, and all the cDNAs in one droplet contain the same barcode, which, because there's only one cell in the droplet, means that all the cDNAs from a single cell contain the same barcode, which means we can map the heavy chain onto the light chain. Then we break the drops, amplify by PCR, that works very nicely. Then we sequence and we analyze. And in fact, we perform three sequential reads using Illumina MiSeq. So a 2x300 base pair paired end read to sequence the antibody genes, and then a third read to sequence the barcode. So we carried out a little control experiment where we mixed three hybridomers. So in 70% of one, 20% of the other, 10% of the third. And then we sequenced them in a couple of different volumes of droplets. And if you, in this case, we know, of course, what the genes are, so it means that you can look at the what percentage of correctly paired VH and VL sequences there are, and do they match up with the barcodes. If you look at the percent of correctly paired genes against the read abundance, what you see is that, in fact, if you only demand that you have one pair of barcode reads, it's a bit rubbish. You only have about 50% of them are correct. But by the time you get up to, certainly like 5 or 10, you're over 90% of the pairs are really correct. And in fact, if you take a fairly conservative a read threshold of 40 reads, which is about here, and you analyze the data, you found that the percent of correctly paired VH and VL sequences is very close to that which is expected based on the ratio of the hybridomas. But of course, what's really interesting is to do this with primary plasma cells. So this is an example of mouse splenocytes that have been sorted for tetanus toxoid binding. So there were about 1 million cells that went in, and there were about 10,000 hits, so it's tetanus toxoid binders. And so you see there are about 19,000 reads with one read per chain, but these are probably mostly rubbish. 5,600 with over equal to or greater than 5 reads, 4,000 with equal to or greater than 10 reads, and 1,700 with equal to and greater than 40 reads. So you see we're not getting, at this level, we're not getting quite all of the hits, but still not so bad. You get a very nice diversity of heavy and light chains. The next step is other things that you've identified, are they real? Do they really bind to the antigen? So first of all, there's the bioinformatics analysis. But then one option is to synthesize the genes, clone, express, clone, transfect, express, and then validate the binding with the expressed IgGs. There is another route, which is a so-called dial-out PCR. And this dial-out PCR is quite interesting because it takes advantage of the fact that the antibody genes are barcoded. So in fact, what you can do is, you know the sequence of the gene, you know the sequence of the barcode, and so in fact, you can do a nested PCR where you use primers which are specific to the individual indexes in the barcode. So these are, in this case, three different indexes were used. And that enables you to dial out by PCR specific sequences. And then they're simply amplified and cloned for expression in CHO cells as IgGs. And then you can analyze them then in a classic way by ELISA. And so what we find is there's a very low false positive rate. So if you take this threshold of 40 read pairs, Only one out of 25 of the dialed out antibodies in this case didn't bind the antigen. You get a mixture of high and low affinity antibodies reflecting the immune response. And of course, it's dialed out PCR. It's a very rapid and inexpensive method for screening hits. In fact, you can go from the bioinformatics analysis to having cloned, expressed, and validated antibodies in only 7 days. And that means the total times, that's B-cell isolation, antibody identification, confirmation, and confirmation of binding, only takes 19 days. So why is it worth going to all this trouble? So it's really all related to the fact that you don't need to immortalize the B-cells because a plasma B-cell produces enough antibodies to screen in only 15 minutes. So that means you can screen non-immortalized B-cells directly from any human or any animal you want. And you can do barcoded deep sequencing to allow mapping of the genotype to the phenotype, and you get the VH and VL pairing. And you can deep mine the antibody repertoire because screening a million cells only takes an hour, whereas typically in a hybridoma experiment, you only screen about 1,000 hybridoma clones, which is only 1/10 to the 5th of the available mouse repertoire. Very low reagent consumption. Screening a million antibodies only requires 100 microliters of reagents compared to 100 liters if you did it in microtiter plates. You can screen for affinity, for off rate. You can also potentially screen for specificity using antigens labeled with different fluorophores. And I didn't talk about here, but you can also screen for other activities that are not just simply binding because the droplets are a very flexible format. And of course, you can do cell-based screening. And here we're particularly interested in novel readouts based on RNA sequencing. And in fact, RNA sequencing is a very simple adaptation of the technique that we use for sequencing the antibodies. Just instead of making cDNA copies of the antibody messenger RNAs, we make cDNA copies of either total RNA or of other targeted RNAs. And this is very attractive because it might be that we could use RNA-seq as a near universal readout for cell-based assays where you can see both on-target and off-target effects. And we're also adapting the same barcoding system for chromatin mapping by ChIP-seq with Edith, amongst others, and profiling of mutations and recombinations. And also, of course, these kind of single-cell droplet sequencing techniques are in general a very powerful tool to analyze heterogeneous cell populations. And in fact, there were two back-to-back publications in Cell in May on droplet-based single-cell RNA-seq using barcoded bead strategies. So we're particularly interested in this capacity to look at tumor persister cells. These are rare therapy-resistant cells which are known to drive cancer recurrence. And this is a really big problem. And I think this slide really illustrates it absolutely perfectly. So here you have this poor guy. He has a fairly advanced melanoma, but he was treated with a BRAF inhibitor. And you see after 15 weeks, he looks perfectly normal. But 23 weeks later, he's relapsed, and you see the nodules have grown again. And what's absolutely amazing is the nodules are in exactly the same place as the original ones, which means that even though he looks like you've cured him here, in every one of these nodules, there were at least one or two cells that survived the treatment. And the trick is, how do you find out what they do and how do you kill them? So we think this could be single-cell analysis techniques could be a very powerful way to identify tumor resistance mechanisms from rare persister cells. Final, very quickly, because my time is up, I know. I want to mention that we can also use this technique for screening and directed evolution of enzymes and microorganisms. And this is also a collaboration with a startup at USPC, Biomillennia. I'm just going to give one example, which is a purely academic example, but I think it's quite fun. This is direct evolution of an artificial aldolase. So for this, we use an integrated microfluidic device to screen an in silico designed retroaldolase, which is expressed in E. coli. So we take cells, E. coli cells, substrate, lysis reagent, they go into drops, they get lysed, then they get incubated, and then we sort the droplets based on fluorescence. And so the original designed enzyme, this came from David Baker's group, so it contained 11 active site mutations which were put into a beta-alpha-8 barrel scaffold. And the designed enzyme, it's 5,000 it's 5,000-fold more active than the uncatalyzed reaction. But when using this directed when using this microbiotic system, we carried out directed evolution, so cycles of mutation and selection. We could further increase the activity by 4 × 10^5-fold. So now the evolved variant is 10^10-fold higher activity than the uncatalyzed reaction. It has 26 additional mutations, and this means that this evolved enzyme it's got a similar efficiency to natural aldolases. And this crystal structure of this enzyme was solved, and what you find is that so the naphthyl site here occupies the original computationally designed site, but in fact the original catalytic apparatus that David Baker's group designed, which is a lyse-210 glutamine 53 and an ordered water molecule, was completely erased, and its place was a well-defined hydrogen bonding network of lysine 83, tyrosine 51, tyrosine 180, and asparagine 110. And just finally, you can also use this kind of same technology for screening enzymes, not just to evolve existing enzymes, but also to screen for new ones. So, for example, we screened 100,000 uncultured soil bacteria from wheat stubble field in less than 20 minutes for cellulitic activity using this technique. And as a final slide, I think these experiments to select for enzyme activity rapidly demonstrate globally one of the main advantages of droplet-based microfluidic systems. So this is an example of one enzyme selection experiment. So we analyzed 5 × 10^7 reactions. If you'd done it with a robotic system, it would have taken about 2 years. It took about 7 hours in the microfluidic system. And the total cost of the experiment in a robotic platform would have been a bit over $15 million, whereas it only cost $2.50 to do it in a microfluidic system. And finally, so I want to just leave you with a list of acknowledgements. So obviously all the group at USPC and our numerous academic and industrial collaborators. And I'd like to thank you for your attention.